Okay, so now we can continue on how to deal with the problems of the mind, how to work with the mind, get rid of those things we want to get rid of and develop those things we want to develop. And of course, one of the main issues in dealing with the mental world is ill will, negativity, anger, and this kind of stuff. Very, very important to get rid of these things. And the Buddha says that if there is one thing that is really detrimental to oneself, it is particularly ill will is one of the worst things. It has very bad consequences in this life, in future lives. But the good side of it is that it is relatively easy to overcome. It's one of the easiest things to overcome among the defilements. So for that reason, it's worthwhile spending a bit of time in this. Some of you, you know, people vary a lot. Some people get irritated and angry quite easily. Other people get angry much less often. But regardless, it's something that is very useful to reduce that problem even further, regardless where you're at, really. That's a good thing to have a look at. And it's a thing that always comes up and always is so fundamental to the Buddhist path. There is a number of suttas that deal with these kind of things, how to deal with bad thoughts in general. Some of those suttas are quite general, but there's one sutta which I like to read out on every retreat because it is very specific about how to overcome these kind of thoughts. I think it's good, even for those of you who have been on these retreats before, it's always nice to be reminded of these things. And there's nice similes in here, and there's always a way of refreshing old ideas and kind of making them stronger and more powerful, more useful in our practice. I certainly enjoy reading this every time. It always reminds me also what I need to do as well. So it's always useful. So this sutta is from the Anguttara Nikaya. It's called Removing Resentment. So removing ill will, anger, etc. And this is spoken by the Venerable Sariputta. Who is of course known to be the right-hand man of the Buddha. If anybody is to teach the Dhamma when the Buddha isn't around, it's Venerable Sariputta is the one. He is the one who can turn the wheel pretty much almost like the master himself. This is how it goes. So there the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus. Those bhikkhus replied, and the Venerable Sariputta said this. It's interesting how they call each other friends, right? It is almost as if they were more informal in those days than people are now. Now in the monasteries, there's kind of in our monastery it's quite relaxed, but often there's a very kind of strict hierarchy. And if you're more junior, you call the more senior Bhante. And if you are more senior, you call the junior by name. And it's kind of strict like that. But in those days, they all seemed to call this other friend before the Buddha passed away. And the Buddha was the only one who was called Bhante in those days. So which is an interesting little side issue. But anyway, we shall move on. Friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. What five? Here, a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So that is the summary of the sutta. We're going to look at each one of these in detail in a second. So this is how the Buddha does, often the suttas are. They're kind of summarized and then expanded. So this is an ancient technique for teaching technique. And of course, the point here is that these five people, they cover everybody. Everyone is included in one of these five categories, which means that there is never really any reason. There's always a way out of ill will, always a way out of anger. It doesn't matter who the person is. There's always something that can be done to overcome that negative mental state, which, of course, is good news, right? It's good news. There's always something we can do about this. So that's excellent. So let's see what it is that we are supposed to do. Get to the meat of this sutta. So the first one, how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-robed bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Right? So, very simple idea that we have here. It is how we look at people, what aspect of the person that we look at, that decides whether we get angry with somebody or not, whether we have resentment or not. How are we looking at somebody else? Everybody, we are all complicated beings. We all have various sides to us, right? And usually you find that people are a mixture of good and sometimes things that are not so good, right? And there's always, depending on what you look at in that person, what is it that decides what we look at? And a lot of what decides what we see in another person is just our habits. If we have a fault-finding habit, we tend to see the faults in other people. If we have a habit of seeing the good in others, that's what we often will see. So it is our habits that tend to drive whether we see the negative or whether we see the positive in somebody else. And because it is all done by habits, it means that it can be changed, it can be redirected in another way. We can start to see things differently. And this is the great thing about this. Remember that sometimes people say, yeah, but you've got to see the truth. You can't kind of, if you just see the good, it's like you're lying in a sense. But the reality is that there isn't any real truth in this. People are complicated. We don't know what the person really is like. We don't know what is going on. So it's not really about truth. The truth isn't really directly accessible in these cases. And anyway, the person is changing, right? So it's not about truth. It is about what is useful that matters. What is useful in these cases? That is the most important thing here. And also remember that if somebody has bad qualities, there's no point in focusing on that. You end up judging the person, all these kind of things. Just remind yourself that people don't want to have bad qualities. If they have them, they have them for reasons that are outside their own ability to control. They have been conditioned into these bad qualities. So as I was saying yesterday, they themselves are victims of their own bad qualities. So in this way, you realize actually focusing on the good is actually a positive thing to do. It actually is something that is useful. And there's no point in pretending that we can have some kind of accurate measure of other people anyway. So you focus on the good things, aspects of somebody. So how do you do that? How do you actually focus on this? But let's have a look at the simile, perhaps, first of all. It's a very nice little simile here, which gives us some idea of how to do this. So you have this rag-robed bhikkhu, right? And a rag-robed bhikkhu is one of the practices that was done in those days and occasionally done today as well, whereby you take rags, wherever you find a rag, that is what you use to sew your robes. So you walk around, you see a bit of cloth in the ditch along the side of the road, in the trenches, and you pull it out, right? And you wash it clean, and then you use it to sew your robes. Practices they did as well was to go to the charnel grounds. The charnel ground is like a cemetery where they just throw away the corpses. And sometimes they would burn them, sometimes they would just lie there to be eaten by animals or whatever. And of course these corpses, they would often have cloth on them, right? And the monks would go there and they would take the cloth off these corpses and they would sew a robe with that. Quite disgusting, right? But... You obviously wash it well and it becomes kind of usable afterwards. But it's a very kind of, the idea is it's supposed to be quite ascetic. You don't use nice cloth. And if it is hard to come by good cloth, these days it's incredibly easy compared to those days, then of course it is a way of getting a robe regardless, basically. Yeah. So these rag robe bhikkhus, right? And you see a rag by the roadside, so I guess he's probably quite happy about that, seeing this rag by the roadside. And then you press it down with the left foot and spread it out with the right foot. And this is like you're getting the overview, right? You spread it out and you kind of have a look at it. And this is like getting an overview of a person. You see the person in all the different qualities, right? These qualities, that qualities. And then when you see the qualities, you don't keep the whole rag. You only keep the rag, part of the rag, which is useful for you. So you tear off all those bad qualities, all those bad parts of the rag. You tear it off. And what do you do with it? You chuck it out. You throw it out because it is rubbish. It is things which leads you away from awakening, leads you away from happiness. It is garbage. You want to get rid of it as soon as possible. You throw it out. Throw out those bad qualities. It's like that old story, or that old simile of how to deal with seeing bad qualities in yourself and other people. And you write it down on a sheet of paper, right? So you have bad qualities here, good qualities there. And when you finish writing it down, you tear the thing down the middle. You take the bad qualities and you flush them down the toilet or something like that. You burn them in the incinerator or whatever. And you kind of eliminate them. That's kind of the idea, right? It gives you a mental image of how you're supposed to deal with this. And this is exactly the same thing which is going on here. Exactly the same simile here. You tear off all the bad stuff and you throw it away because it's rubbish. It's useless. It is bad. It takes you away from happiness and nibbana and all of these kind of things. And what you take with you is the intact part, right? The part that you can sew with a robe, and you carry it with you. You take it into your pocket, you take it into your little bag or whatever, or into your bowl perhaps, whatever it is that you have, and you carry it with you. In the same way, you remind yourself of the good qualities of other people. You take it into your heart, take it into your mind, and you carry those qualities around with you. And whenever you need those qualities, you bring them out of your heart, right? And you think, or you remind yourself, okay, these are the good qualities. So it's the same way, and those are the ones you carry with you, and the rest of it, you just chuck it out. And so you take it away, you take those qualities with him. Of course, to be able to do this, what we often have to do is that we have to spend a little bit of time reminding ourselves of the good qualities in other people, right? So, you know, for example, the people who come on retreats, it's often good to do a bit of metta to the people around you as well. Because when we live close together, it's very easy to sometimes get a bit irritated. Everybody does little things that for us doesn't seem right. Right? That's just the way it is. So it's good to just remind yourself that when you are on a retreat like this, these are people around you who are really trying really hard, right? Trying their very best, who are living a very wholesome life, very good life. They want to develop themselves. They want to be of help in the world. And what a wonderful thing it is to be around people like this. And remember that. And when you remember that big picture, then those little irritations or whatever, they tend to just fall by the wayside. As soon as the irritation arises, you remind yourself, wait a minute, why am I looking at that? There's something over here. There's a mountain of good qualities over here. And I'm looking at a little molehill, right? What am I doing that for? So change your perception away from that molehill of bad qualities up over to the mountain of good qualities instead. And then that soothes your mind, soothes you down, and you feel peaceful as a consequence. One of the difficulties often in doing this is that we have to have a certain degree of mindfulness. So it's easier to do this often while you are on retreat because your mind is less distracted. So you get a chance to use this technique here while you're on retreat. And the earlier you catch that negative thought, the easier it is to switch perception, switch attention and attend to something else instead. So the earlier you catch it, the easier it is. Once a negative thought catches hold of your mind, it becomes like this monster inside of you, and it's very hard to overcome. And sometimes you just have to wait for the anger to kind of, or negativity to die down. If you catch it early, it is much easier to switch your attention over to something else. So you need to remind yourself, first of all, build up this picture of good qualities inside of you. If there's somebody you're having difficulties with in your life, remind yourself while you're on retreat, what are the good qualities of this person? Now is the chance to develop that perception. These are perceptions you develop. And the more powerful that side of that person becomes, the easier it is to switch your attention over when the time comes and something negative happens. So this is how, and this is not too difficult to do. This is something everybody can do. It is not so, that hard, and especially in a retreat situation like this, you can learn how to do that. So if you are struggling with negativity, and everybody is every now and again, so then this is the recommended way according to the suttas. So it must be powerful, the recommended way of dealing with this. This particular technique is also mentioned in one of the other important suttas about how to deal with defilements, the Vitakka Santana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya number 20. It's a very nice sutta about how to deal with unwholesome qualities in the mind. And in that sutta, as it says precisely, it's exactly this, but there it is generalized to any kind of unwholesome quality. And it says that if the object you are watching gives rise to unwholesome thoughts, then you look at another object or another aspect in that object, which then gives rise to wholesome thoughts instead. You just switch your attention across. Sometimes that method is called substitution. Some people call it that. I'm not sure if substitution does full justice to this technique, because you actually have to remember that. Remember, it's an aspect of wisdom here, right? You know that an object is complex, it has many sides, and you remember this different side, then you swap your attention accordingly. So it's more than just mere substitution. It's an aspect of wisdom that you have, kind of homegrown wisdom, if you like, that you apply in this kind of situations. And one of the things about this is that sometimes, you know, the question arises, well, if you get angry with somebody, is it because the person really has bad qualities? When you see the bad qualities in somebody, are you actually seeing bad qualities? Or is it just you making it up? Is it just you seeing stuff which isn't there? And actually, that is actually quite irrelevant. It doesn't matter where it comes from. All you know is that you are getting upset by something. Whether the person is really bad or good or whatever that is kind of irrelevant. You are upset about something, and that is what matters in this particular situation. It's got nothing really to do with the other person. It has to do with your own mind, the own qualities, and what you're dealing with in your own spiritual life, so to speak. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. It says here that, you know, you have bodily behavior which is impure, but verbal behavior that is pure. And I'm not sure if that particular division means anything. I think it just means that, okay, some aspects are good, some are bad, and you change your perception accordingly. Okay. So that is the first one. Let us move on to the second one. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So this is very similar to the preceding one, right? You're just swapping around. Now it's a different set of qualities that are good, other qualities that are bad. But the simile here is different. And this is another very beautiful simile. You come to this pond, right, which is covered with algae and water plants. So the pond is like the person, right? And this person is covered, these are the defilements, right? And algae and water plants are like the simile for the defilements or the bad qualities in that person. They are the simile in this case, specifically for the impurity in verbal behavior, specifically in this particular case. But you can generalize to say these are the bad qualities you see in somebody else. But then the man, this man arrives, right? And he is afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. And this is what it's like to have resentment or anger or ill will, right? You are hot inside. It's problematic. You feel parched. You need to cool down somewhere. It's an oppression and an affliction to be angry. This is part of the message here as well. It is not something nice. Sometimes we get angry and we kind of feel slightly empowered by it. There's like a little bit of a power trip in getting angry in a sense. But really, when you feel what it's like, it feels hot, it feels unpleasant. There's a lot of craving and agitation going with that anger. It takes you away from the present moment and it leaves a sense of strong dissatisfaction, really. That's actually what's going on there. So if sometimes we need to feel the feelings, what they actually feel like, rather than focus on the object, which just gives rise to more anger. And that can take you away from this. Right? So you are this afflicted person and you want to get rid of your affliction. So when you get rid of that affliction, the way to do that is to plunge into the pond. You sweep away the algae and the water plants. In other words, you don't look at that bad verbal behavior, impure verbal behavior. Instead, you drink from your cupped hands, right, and then leave. You imbibe all those good qualities in the pond, all the goodness, all the good bodily behavior, whatever is there, and you drink that. You drink them in. You take them on board. Fill your mind with these things. Fill your heart with these things. And then, of course, as a consequence, you cool down. You become cool again. The anger dissipates. The ill will goes away. And you feel relaxed. And you feel at ease. And you come back into the present moment. This beautiful idea of drinking, imbibing those good qualities, filling your mind with those, and leaving aside all the bad stuff, which only destroys your happiness and destroys your spiritual practice as well, and disables your meditation practice. So remember one of the questions that I had yesterday? I should maybe bring that up now. I said I was going to talk about it later on, and this might be a good time. And somebody asked about when ill thoughts appear during meditation. How do you do that? And this is what you do, right? So here, this is the answer to your question from yesterday. I'm not sure exactly what you meant by ill thoughts, but these here are definitely ill thoughts. Resentment is definitely ill thought. So this is what you do. And you use these techniques both in your meditation and also in daily life. They are workable across the board, right? They are much easier to use in meditation because hopefully in meditation you have a bit of awareness, unless you're falling asleep perhaps or something, but generally speaking, if you have a bit of awareness in your meditation, you can see quite quickly that you're heading in the wrong direction. And because you can see quite quickly, you can catch yourself and you can direct your attention elsewhere. Sometimes in daily life, you don't really notice it until you are quite upset already. And then it can be very hard to do this technique. You can still try it and still try to move away, but sometimes it can become quite difficult. I will talk about some other techniques as well afterwards of dealing with ill will, which can be more useful perhaps when the anger is already more powerful or more settled inside of you. So this is very useful everywhere. Change your attention. That sutta I was mentioning before, the Vitakka Santana Sutta, the calming of bad thoughts, Majjhima Nikaya 20, it specifically says that these are the techniques that you use to enable you to achieve the adhicitta. The adhicitta, the higher mind, basically means samadhi and the jhanas. So this is things that you actually use in your meditation practice according to that sutta. Okay, so let's look at the next person. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Suppose there is a little water in a puddle. Then a person might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and depart. It's a nice image, right? You can see this monk or person sucking things up like a cow. He then gets down on all fours, sucks the water up like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, a placidity of the mind. On that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the placidity of mind he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here we have a person with just a small amount of good qualities, right? And quite a lot of bad qualities. Bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure. But he gains this opening of the mind. And this here seems to mean that sometimes you gain kind of peace of mind, you gain a bit of calm, you gain a bit of tranquility. Vivarana citta is almost like the opposite of the nivaranas. Nivaranas are the hindrances. It's like a mind which is kind of peaceful, free of hindrances. He gains this occasionally here. Right? It's strange, isn't it, how the world sometimes is. Sometimes the kind of the really scallywags, they come on, they do many bad things, and they sit down and get some good meditation, right? And you think, wow, that's really unfair. I've been practicing the five precepts for so long, and I hate prison, and here comes this dodgy character, sits down and gets nice meditation straight away here. But this is because we are so complex. It's not because it is good to do bad, right? You have to understand these things in the right way. It's just that we are so complicated. We come from such diverse backgrounds, from such, you know, this whole backstory going back eons in the past, that is very difficult to judge anybody here. And sometimes even the scallywags in the world can get good meditation. And this is what this is saying, right? So then you are happy for them, instead of being jealous and saying, no, that's unfair. You're happy for the person instead. You say, wow, what a wonderful thing, right? It's great that you can achieve these things. And you actually are happy. This is kind of the mudita, right? You're happy for that person instead. So this is when what you focus on. You focus on that small little aspect of good qualities in this person. Of course, here you have to be careful, right? You have to be careful because there are bad characteristics to the left, bad features to the right. If you look a little bit high, too high, a little bit too far down, you see the bad things again. So you have to keep very focused. You have to keep on that narrow field of things that are good personal qualities. That's like getting down on all fours and sucking up the water very carefully. And that will ease the heat, right? If you are angry and you get some nice cool water, that's really all you require. There's no big pond, there is a little bit of water, but that's enough to kind of calm you down and make you peaceful. This is more obviously a bit more difficult because it takes more ability to sustain your attention and to develop that narrow field of good personal qualities. But again, it can be done. And one of the things about this, which is interesting about this, is that you can see here that the Buddha goes to great, or this, in this case, Venerable Sariputta, he goes to great length to try to focus on the good qualities in people, right? You go, even if there's just a little bit there, you should try to focus on those good qualities. The next person here is about the person where you cannot see anything good, right? And then you have to use a different technique, because if you can't see anything good, this becomes impossible. But as long as there is something good there, he says, you should try to focus on those good qualities, if at all possible. And that is, I think, a very important lesson for us, because what it means is that metta, friendliness, kindness, goodwill, is something we should develop prior to developing compassion or karuna. Or we should develop them together, but if at all possible, we should focus on the metta first. And I think the reason for that is because metta is always a very positive force. If you see the good qualities in other people, it's always going to be good. It cannot really be harmful in any way at all. It's always going to lead in the right direction. Well, it cannot be harmful. I'm sure it's possible to kind of distort everything. If you know, sometimes these things happen. But generally speaking, it can't be harmful. Compassion, on the other hand, is often related to understanding the suffering of other people, right? And it doesn't take that much. If you get the kind of compassion feeling slightly wrong, you focus in slightly the wrong area, what you do instead, you get depressed because you see so much of the suffering in the world, right? Or it lets you down. You lose that happiness which compassion is supposed to give you. So that is the danger in the area of compassion, is that it's so, because it is related to suffering quite closely, you get it slightly wrong, and it doesn't give you that lift, that boost, which metta always will give you. So this is how I understand this, and why there is this very strong emphasis here on trying to have metta first of all, and then in the end, if the metta doesn't work, then of course you come to compassion, and that is what this next one is about. Okay, so let us look at the one with compassion and see what Venerable Sariputta has to say about this. And how, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and who does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of mind from time to time? Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. He would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man traveling along the highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man does not encounter calamity and disaster right here." So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body after death, he will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed." So this is the time to develop compassion, right? When somebody has all the wrong qualities, and again, it doesn't really matter if the person actually has all bad qualities, or we just perceive all bad qualities. Either way, it doesn't really make much difference. It is from our point of view that matters in this case. This is the time to develop compassion. The interesting thing about this is that what we are doing here, very often if you meet somebody who lack lots of bad qualities, you get upset in return, right? "Oh, all these bad qualities, you're affecting me in a bad way by all your bad vibes. Bad vibes of body, bad vibes my speech, bad vibes my thought, and I feel really negative. You're kind of dragging me down as well by all these bad things, saying bad things to me." And we are focusing on ourselves, right? It's natural that we are quite self-centered, because we are, you know, obviously the person closest in the world to us is precisely ourselves. So a certain degree of self-centeredness is just completely natural. And it's actually a good thing. The Buddha says, if we're going to help anybody in this world, we should always help ourselves first. For two reasons: we are closest to ourselves, and we have much more power to do something for ourselves than we have to do things for others. So it is natural that we are focused on ourselves. But this shows us that actually, in this case, it is not very useful, right? If you focus on yourself, you think how difficult it is for you, you're not going to get out of it that way anyway. So instead, you shift your focus back on the other person. You look at the world from their perspective. And from their perspective, what they are doing is disastrous. Right? They think that they are doing the right thing, probably. Or they think that, or the conditioning is so strong, they can't really help themselves. But they are heading towards tremendous suffering. They probably have lots of suffering already, but they are moving towards much more of it in the future as a consequence of their behavior. So it is like a sick person. A sick person, if they don't get a doctor, if they don't get any medicine, then that sick person is going also to move towards enormous amounts of suffering, death, right? Or deadly suffering, as it says in the suttas, moving towards all these negative things. And this is exactly the same thing happening here. It's a wonderful way, when you meet somebody really difficult, think of them as a sick person, an ill person, somebody worthy of compassion. It's that same thing, you know, when you really see somebody who is sick, you tend to have compassion, right? You don't blame them. And in exactly the same way, this person here too is really sick. They are conditioned in this way. Just as when your physical body is sick, you have been conditioned into that sickness, and it's not really, you can't really be blamed for it. In the same way, when you are mentally sick like this, you have been conditioned into that mental sickness. And there's usually there's nothing really that the person could do about these things. This is the teaching of anatta. It goes against the natural grain inside of us, which feels we are responsible. You are responsible for your own badness, right? That's what it feels like. And we have to recondition ourselves a little bit to understand that our ability to control things in the world is so limited. We have much less responsibility than it feels like we have. And once you get into that anatta, non-self idea, the ability to have compassion, to forgive and let go, just increases enormously here, because a responsibility is no longer there in the same way here. So a wonderful little simile here. And I'm not sure exactly if all the aspects of the simile has any meaning or not. I'm not really sure what is meant here by all of this, but perhaps the suitable food and the medicine might be things like the Dhamma, right, which teaches you the right way. The qualified attendant might be a Dhamma teacher, and perhaps the leader of the village district, maybe that's the Buddha himself, who he doesn't get to meet. Perhaps something like that. You have no Dhamma in your heart, so you see things in the wrong way, and as a consequence you're heading in the wrong direction because of that. So this is the time to have compassion. And you can now start to see why there is nobody in the world that you really have to be angry with. There's always a way out. This doesn't mean that you are going to get there very quickly. You're still going to get angry occasionally. But it means that you can reduce it further. You can always reduce things further, always bring them down. As you do that, you're also enhancing your ability to have metta and have these good qualities in its place. And one day you have so much metta, you can't get angry anymore. We'll have a look at that tomorrow morning, what that means, because that is also possible according to the suttas. There's some very powerful and nice similes about that coming up tomorrow morning here. Okay, so that is the compassion side. And now we are going to look at the last type of person. This goes as follows. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure and who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clean with smooth banks, and a delightful place shaded by various trees. Then a man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe and drink, and then after coming out, he would sit and lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion, one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, to his pure verbal behavior, and to the opening of the mind, the placidity of mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. So here we have the good person, right? This is like the person who gains samadhi, who has beautiful conduct, who probably is an arya, who perhaps is an arahant, right? With all these wonderful qualities. And of course, then somebody comes along and they still get angry with this person, right? You see that in the sutta as getting angry with the Buddha, getting angry with the arahants. Because this is just the nature of the mind, that we get angry every now and again. It's got nothing necessarily to do with the people outside. It just has to do with our own nature. So even in this case, we've got to deal with that anger. But in this case, it's easy, because there is so much, the pond is, in this case, is clear. There's no algae and water plants on the top. All it has is sweet, cool water, and you can plunge into that beautiful water, and you drink it, right? You drink it down, imbibe all those good qualities, and very quickly, the oppression of the anger, the oppression of the ill will, the feeling thirsty and parched, heat inside, it just dies down so fast because of all the good qualities that are there. But even in this case, we need to remind ourselves of those good qualities. And then, on top of that, in this case, after you come out of that water, right, bathing, you're bathing in those good qualities. It's another nice metaphor. You're kind of immersing yourself completely in the good qualities of another person. And then afterwards, because there's also smooth banks there, right? A delightful place, shaded by various trees. It's as if that aura of this good person, it kind of spreads out around him or her. Then you kind of hang around, right? You don't leave that person. You sit down in the shade of those trees. It's like you become a disciple of that person. That seems to be perhaps one way of reading the simile. You become a disciple because you realize, wow, there's something powerful going on, it's something wonderful. And as it says further down, then the mind gains confidence, right? It gains saddha in that person. So here it seems to be what we're talking about is somebody actually becoming a disciple of that person, is what is perhaps going on here. So this is kind of the beauty of somebody very powerful like that, right? You see that there's something special about this person. And you can see that when you are in the presence of people like that. We're talking about, somebody asked about when I met Ajahn Ganha recently, right? And you get into the presence of somebody like that, you get this feeling, wow, this is special, this is different. Most people aren't like this. Most people aren't able to have such very positive qualities continuously over long periods of time. This is really rare. And you get this feeling, oh, I would like to develop some of these things. There's a natural attraction there. You're attracted to people with a very strong sense of metta and kindness. It's very hard to avoid that kind of attraction. And you just want to be around them because it feels so nice. You feel so easy. You feel so relaxed. There's nothing to prove anymore. They will be friendly with you regardless of what you do, right? It's kind of unconditional friendship, unconditional love, if you like, that is there. And this is how you then end up with becoming a disciple of somebody here. And that is, of course, why also, as I was saying a couple of days ago, this idea that just seeing an arahant in the world, seeing somebody like that, is very powerful for you here, because it means that you're seeing something different. You get this glimpse of something, of a possibility of something more profound, something different than ordinary life. And that gives you hope. It gives you a boost in your spiritual practice. It gives you this oomph that you can then carry on in your own life afterwards. You think, wow, this is possible. Okay, wow, great. And you kind of, hopefully, you then start practicing accordingly yourself. So that is the last one there. This is the kind of person who really inspires confidence in one. And this is why it is so important still in the world to have Aryas, noble people, to still have arahants around. And why it matters that we have people who practice in the right way, who practice well, and who get the real results. Because they are really inspiring, right? They are living examples. One thing is reading the suttas. And reading the suttas is great. It's a wonderful thing to do. But sometimes you also need the living example to show you that it can be done. Just reading the suttas, it's just paper, it's just words, and it's hard to kind of translate it into reality. But when you have the suttas combined with the living example, that is when these teachings become incredibly powerful. You have the ancient teachings that are there, that are kind of behind the scenes, that are kind of support the practice, and that show you that it is a a real thing that has been going on for a long time. It's not just some kind of crazy guy who's walking around the street saying, I'm enlightened or whatever. You have that support from this ancient tradition. And then this person who has all those qualities and who kind of respects that tradition, right? There's something bigger than all of us, which is great. Even an arahant will bow down to the Buddha, bow down to the Dhamma. Even the Buddha said he respected the Dhamma. Why? Because he said it's astonishing some of the things the Buddha said, but he actually said it is suffering not to have something to respect, right? It is suffering in the world not to have something to have confidence and faith in. If you have confidence and faith in something, it makes you happy. It is something positive in your life. Even the Buddha said that. So he said, well, who should I have faith in? Or what should I have faith in? Well, there is nobody else in the world I can really have faith in, so I'm going to just have faith in the Dhamma, or respect the Dhamma, if you like. That was the Buddha's answer. And that is one of those great things also about being part of a big tradition, is that nobody kind of gets too big-headed, right? Everybody gets kind of, we all have something we can respect that is higher than all of us, and which is a very positive thing, because it means that we don't have any kind of absolute spiritual leader apart from the Buddha himself. Okay, so these are the five ways of removing resentment, by means of which a bhikkhu can entirely remove resentment towards whomever it has arisen. So these are wonderful teachings, and I would recommend you to reflect on these things. They're very useful things to use and to take to remove even a little bit more of that ill will or whatever might be there. Maybe just to add a few things more to what has been said already, just to reiterate a few things I've said, also have said before. This is very useful, but there are many ways of dealing with ill will, and one of the ways that I have always found very powerful, and I know other people also find it powerful, and this is one of the things that I have been talking about already, that is always to remember this idea of non-self, right? This idea that we are like, in many ways, we are like a ship on the ocean. A ship on the ocean without an engine, without a rudder, without any kind of steering mechanism. And if you are a ship on the ocean without any kind of way of navigating or steering yourself, you are going to be completely at the mercy of the elements, right? If the winds and the currents blow one way, you're going to follow the winds and the current according to where they go. There is no way that you can control yourself in any way. And it's useful to think of people like that. People are like these ships in samsara without any rudder inside. There's no mechanism inside of you that guides you anywhere. The only mechanism that is there is the conditioning and all the things that have influenced you in this life and also in earlier lifetimes. So you are a victim. You are at the mercy of all this conditioning that has happened to you over such a long period of time. And you will go according to that, right? You will move according to that. And this is why, precisely why the Buddha says that the Kalyanamitta, the Buddha himself, is 100% of living the spiritual life. Because unless you have that one guide, that one thing that sets you off on the right course, right? Who launches the boat into the ocean, okay, go this way, and you kind of set sail in the right direction. If you haven't got that, you will just be at the mercy of all the conditioning inside and outside of you. So this is such a great way of thinking about people. And when you look at people like that, you stop thinking, you stop kind of blaming them, right? Because they are just a victim of their own conditioning. They have got here because of all these things in the past. And there are some great stories about that. There's one story in particular, which I heard a couple of years ago, and which I have spoken about on a number of occasions. But this was just the story of this man who went through this, somebody else mentioned this here as well, he went through this hypnotic regression, and he thinks that he remembered a past life, and he thought so because so many of the things that he remembered there fitted with a particular person's life in the past. There were just lots and lots of things that kind of fell into place. What he said, the most disturbing thing he said about that experience was how he could see how the traits of his character had just carried on from one life to the next one. Right? He was sitting here in this life, and he quite he was doing quite well in business, making money for himself, selling some IT stuff to the mining companies or something like that, and kind of, you know, doing really well. And then he felt proud, right? I have built up this thing for myself, which is natural. People feel proud about their successes, having done well in life. But then he saw that he had exactly the same character in the past. He had kind of built up this farm somewhere in the southwest of Western Australia, built up his farm from nothing, being a very poor migrant coming from overseas, building all this up. And he felt very proud about his success. And then in this life, he thought that he had voluntarily started this business, building things up. But then when he saw who he was in the past life, he saw he was just playing out this program, playing out these habits, playing out the conditioning that had been laid down in him somewhere in the unknown past. And he said he got this sense of aversion, right? A sense of, what? You know, I'm like a robot running on the same program. That's what he could see. And this, of course, is one of the powerful things you start to see when you start to see deeply into your past, how conditioned you actually are. And it makes you want to rebel. It makes you want to say, no, I don't want this anymore. I'm stuck, right? This is really what the Buddha says. We are stuck in samsara, going round and round without really realizing it, being conditioned the way we are. And then you want to rebel. And what you want to rebel against is precisely your conditioning, your habits, getting out of that and moving on. So remember, people are stuck. They are stuck in the habits, stuck at whatever they are, whatever kind of bad qualities they have, it is stuck. They are the first victim of those bad qualities. Change your perception. Stop thinking about, oh, I have to suffer this person. No, they are much more a victim than you are. What you're getting is only a tiny fraction of what they are getting themselves. That's a very powerful way of reflecting, I find. You can try that as well, because if you wish, it's just a suggestion, of course, but it may be useful for you. So that is one. There's also another one which is very related to that, a way of thinking about how to overcome negative thoughts and ill will, and that is to remember that when somebody does something to you, the problem is often that it feels personal, right? They are doing this to me. What right have they got to do this towards me? I haven't done anything towards them. Why are they speaking to me like that? It feels personal, and that's why we get upset. If you take the personal aspect out of it, if you understand that it's got nothing to do with personality, it's got nothing to do with them against you or whatever, it has only it has to do with the other person. It has to do with their life, what they are like. And if you take that idea that it's not personal, out of the equation, again, it tends to reduce the upset and anger and the negative kind of negativity you might feel against them. Anger is always, we get upset because it feels personal. Reflect on that for a second and you will see that that is often very true. If the person did the same bad thing against somebody else, you might feel it is bad or unfair, but you would never get nearly as upset as when it is done towards you personally. Okay, so that is some of the ways of dealing with resentment, anger, and ill will, and all these kind of things. See if you can, if that becomes useful in your life, and if you can, maybe this can help you to deepen your meditation a little bit more. And of course, what we are doing here as well, if you're overcoming anger, what you're also doing at the same time is that you're also building up the other side of things. You're building up the metta. As the anger goes down, the ability to practice metta and to be kind and friendly to other people, that is going up at the same time. These are kind of working together, right? So because of that, what we're going to look at next is precisely the practice of metta and how that is described in the suttas, because that kind of follows naturally on from this. And then we can move into that area. For now, I think we will probably have to look at that tomorrow morning. So tomorrow we're back to our old program again. And for now, I think we'll stop at that. And we'll see you again this evening at 7:30.